Our next case is E&I Global Energy Services versus the United States, 2022-1472. Mr. Kernan.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. I'm Patrick Kernan here on behalf of E&I Energy Services Incorporated. We're before the Court on several issues before the Court. This contract was undermined by lack of good faith and fair dealing by the government on this contract. As you all know, this contract started with a contract that was terminated for the default by Isolux by the government. E&I took over the contract. First, they did a completion agreement with a surety, and then they did a tender agreement with the government. Within those agreements, there was a provision that the surety would pay outstanding debts and deal with the subcontractors and suppliers on the contract. My client relied on that contract and began performing on his contract. And the fact that the suppliers and the sureties were not, suppliers and the subcontractors were not paid, it hindered his performance on the contract. It would be similar to a situation where the government had entered into a contract with another contractor to remove boulders, and they did nothing, and the government just sat by and did nothing. Go ahead, perform the contract, get it done, completed, whatever way you want. There was only two options in this case for E&I. It was either to pay off those subcontractors and suppliers in order to get them to perform and finish the contract, or default on the contract. My client went forward and paid those subcontractors, acting in good faith, and moved forward on the contract.
Did you reach out to the sureties before paying the creditors?
Yes, Your Honor. There was efforts to get the surety to pay, but it was the government's responsibility. The government had the contract with the surety. My client didn't have that agreement with the surety to be able to force them to pay the subcontractors and suppliers. So my client was in a position having to rely on the government, yet the government did not do anything other than default my client.
What would be the consequence if this termination for default were converted to a termination for convenience, the financial consequence of that?
The details of the financials have not been worked out because we haven't got to that point.
I'm not asking for specifics. Just in general, what would you recover that you wouldn't otherwise recover?
Well, the T4C costs would be any costs incurred on the contract, direct costs, overhead costs that would have been incurred on the contract. So that would include the payments made to the subcontractors and suppliers on the contract, other direct labor, and costs on the contract. The main thing for my client, though, is conversion to T4C. As you know, a termination for default is a death penalty for a contractor. Without even being able to present any evidence on it, the termination for default was sustained on a summary judgment motion, which is most unusual, without any factual analysis.
Well, your theory, or one of your theories, is that the failure of the sureties to pay the subcontractors and suppliers led to your default, right?
It's one factor. Our position is that we did substantially complete the contract. As you know, the contract was not...
That issue wasn't raised below. Just stick with the one I'm asking you about.
Yes, Your Honor.
You raised the theory that the default was caused by the failure of the sureties, right?
The failure of the government to force the surety to pay, make the surety pay the suppliers.
Well, so, also the failure of the sureties to do it, right? To perform
right.
their obligation.
Right.
Which wasn't your responsibility.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't see that theory as having been addressed by the Court of Federal Claims.
In respect to rejecting that theory, they dismissed the count for failure to fulfill the good faith and fair dealing on the contract.
Well, yes, but that's a different issue, it seems to me,
yeah,
than whether the default, whether the failure to perform on time was excusable because it wasn't your responsibility, but rather the caused by the sureties, failure to perform their responsibilities.
Correct. That was one of our arguments, that it was beyond our control and was excusable termination, excusable delay on the contract. That the Court of Federal Claims basically just, you know, dismissed it out of hand. There wasn't a lot of analysis on that, I would agree, in the decision by the court. But our position is that the lack of analysis by the Court of Federal Claims, in, you know, is something that this Court should reverse the Court of Federal Claims because of the lack of analysis and send it back to the Court for further analysis of the factual circumstances presented to my client. So that the...
Give me your best citation in the record for where you raised that argument below that Judge Dyke was just describing.
The factual analysis in the case, it was limited trial below. It was just minor issues that were presented to the court. There was only two witnesses presented. The main area where we presented, we did a motion for summary judgment, and in the motion for summary judgment, we presented that issue of substantial...
If you can just give me a page, whether it's now or on your rebuttal, if you need to do
on
rebuttal, that's fine. Okay. That would be helpful.
I don't have the hard copies of the record. I have the electronic copies.
Wherever. I don't care if it's electronic. I don't care if it's in paper. Just a page site would be wonderful.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the termination by default, we also raise two other issues, that the substantial completion, that we completed 95% of the contract. The substation was powered at the time the contract was terminated. There was innuendo that my client had abandoned the project and was no longer proceeding, but that's not the case. They were continuing to perform. There is no record evidence that they were not continuing to perform on the contract. And there was no analysis by the Court of Federal Claims as to whether or not they substantially completed the contract. They also, Court of Federal Claims, failed to address whether or not the government waived the completion date of the contract. The contract was terminated 45 days after the completion date of the contract, and no completion date was reset by the government. And prior to termination, the contract was terminated, and my client continued to perform during that 45-day period. The Court of Federal Claims did not address either of those issues in its analysis before upholding the termination for default. There are two other areas in the contract that we address in our briefs. The first is dismissal of invoices 1346, 1391, 1420, and 1422. The Court of Federal Claims said that my client could not recover on those invoices because the plans and specifications were provided to my client publicly. As we address in our brief, the public providing of the plans was under a different contract number, which would have been impossible for my client to obtain that information or have knowledge that that those plans and specifications were out there. For the government to then say that my client is responsible for plans and specifications that they never presented to them and were under a different contract number publicly, it should not be sustained by this court, and it's an error by the court below. Moreover, there was other invoices that my client submitted related to changes in the contract. They were dismissed by the court because there was not proper notice given of those invoices.
When you said it was a different contract number, are you referring to the contract number for the ISILIPS contract? What are you referring to when you say it's a different
contract? Even before the ISILIPS contract, so the solicitation number. So when the solicitation is issued, the plans and specification are under the solicitation number. That was different than the contract number for the ISILIPS contract. So my client was aware of the ISILIPS contract number. They were not aware of the solicitation number in order to pull up the plans and specifications. The court, and their only finding was that my client was responsible because the plans were publicly available, and that's the only basis for the decision that my client could not recover on those invoices. if you look at the invoice with respect to the changes, the court below said that my client could not recover on those changes because they did not provide proper notice to the government. But the Court of Federal Claims provided no analysis of whether or not my client or the government could have done anything else, or could have recovered, done that work less expensively or through another method. There's leniency has been allowed by this court for notice requirements for changes if the government has not detrimentally affected by the lack of notice. And despite the fact that there was no evidence that the government was detrimentally affected, my client was out those costs. The government didn't, or the Court of Federal Claims did not analyze whether or not the lack of notice impacted the government and should bar my client from recovery.
Is it accurate that you represented that you'd read the entirety of the Isolates contract, including any amendments? Is
that yes, Your Honor. That was part of the contract. It's a standard part of any government contract that you review the contract and amendments. But as a boilerplate language, if something was an amendment was in the public record under a different contract number, my client wouldn't be able to, would have thought they had the complete record presented to them based on the contract numbers. And if you look at the information on page 136, I think it is, of the contract, where they reference the prior contracts, there is no documents prior to 2016 and in that reference. So my client would have been unaware of any prior amendments prior to that date. The date of the amendment, too, which is the one at issue here, was July 24th, 2015. And the reference in the contract to amendments and specifications on page 136 was everything after 2016. So there was nothing directly in evidence other than the apparent reference to the public record, which was under a different contract number. For these reasons, the error in the dismissal of the count for good lack of good faith and fair dealing on the contract, for the error in sustaining the termination for default on a summary judgment with no factual analysis of the major issues for termination for default, for the error in dismissing the invoices for the work done under plans and specifications they weren't aware of, and for the invoices, error in the invoices for the work that was done with in the government's opinion, not proper notice, we would ask that this court reverse on those four issues and present to remand the case to the Court of Federal Claims for further findings.
One housekeeping question. You said page 136. Are you talking about appendix page 136?
No, the contract. Contract page 136. And I'll give you the appendix reference when we go back.
Please. Please give it to me on rebuttal.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Harlow.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Chris Harlow for the United States. I'll start with the reimbursement claim.
Well, it seems to me there's an issue that you don't respond to in your brief. One of the counts of the complaint is improper termination for default. And they've argued that it wasn't their failure that led to the default in the performance of the contract, but the failure of the sureties to, as required, pay the suppliers and subcontractors. So why isn't that a legitimate theory that needed to be addressed by the Court of Federal Claims and couldn't be resolved on summary judgment?
So, Your Honor, the reason that they explained for failing to perform was that they had essentially run out of money because they had given it to the predecessor contractors, subcontractors. And once they ran out of money, their employees and their subcontractors stopped coming to work. And when that happened, they blamed that on the surety, yes. But what they told the court was it shouldn't be a default termination because that's beyond our control. What we explained to the court at the summary judgment stage and what the Judge Tapp found as well is that if you look at these contract documents, they spell out the procedures for which the surety and E&I to work out these problems. E&I didn't do any of that.
I'm not understanding. I mean, maybe there were procedures under the contract for them to force the sureties to pay, but when it gets to a default termination, they're saying the failure of the sureties to pay was what caused our default.
No,
it caused our financial problems and led to the default.
Yeah, it's a little bit more nuanced than that because it's not that the sureties didn't pay; it's that E&I took it on their own to make these payments. That's why they went out of business.
Because the sureties failed to pay.
But there was no by not following the procedures that are in the contract. We don't know that. We know that the
if they ended up in default because the sureties didn't perform their obligation, wouldn't that be an excusable situation?
If they had raised that argument, but that's not what happened here, and it's not how they raised it. It's the act of E&I making these payments. It's independent of the sureties because E&I never followed those procedures.
How is it independent of the sureties? They're saying we had to pay because the sureties didn't.
But that's not the actual argument that they're making. They're arguing that they made these payments and that's why they went out of business or why they could no longer perform. The sureties never had this opportunity.
They're not arguing that they had to pay because the sureties defaulted in their obligation?
Your Honor, no, we don't, there's no evidence that they followed any of those procedures.
So what? I mean.
Because I think we get to a core aspect of what the counsel here said, which was he didn't have a contract. E&I didn't have a contract with Liberty Mutual. They did. That's the completion agreement. What the government bargained for here was to take this dispute and put it between E&I and Liberty Mutual. Whatever problems or debts existed with the predecessor contract, the specific thing that the Department of Energy and WAPA contracted for here was for them to resolve those disputes. And that contract sets out how that's supposed to work.
What could E&I have done besides pay these contractors directly? Can you tell us exactly what they could have done and give us some citations, too, to help with that?
Well, I mean, as a practical matter, what they needed to do was bring suit against Liberty Mutual. And you know what happened? That's exactly what they did after they brought this lawsuit and explained to them what these contract documents provided for. They brought suit against Liberty Mutual in the district court in South Dakota. That case is ongoing right now. That's where everything, they didn't follow the procedures.
You can't argue that there's no excuse in the contract because they didn't sue Liberty Mutual earlier. That's bizarre.
No, they didn't follow the procedures that are outlined in that completion agreement.
Why can't you excuse a default because another party didn't perform its obligations? Why do you say that your only remedy is to sue the other party?
Because it's E&I that didn't fulfill their obligations. That agreement says E&I is not allowed to do what they did. It says that you cannot make these payments without
the consent. Where does it say that? Where's the
Section 17 of the completion agreement.
What page?
Section 17.
Give us an appendix page site, please.
0085 and 86?
Yes, that's exactly right, Your Honor. 85 and 86 to the appendix.
And what language will you cite? Do you want to cite?
It's the third paragraph.
On 86?
Of 86, yes, Your Honor. And it's the first sentence. Neither party will consent to the entry of any judgment or enter any settlement with respect to any third-party claim without the prior consent of the other party.
That has nothing to do with preventing them from paying the subcontractor so they could go forward.
You're
stating that something is in this contract which simply isn't there.
Neither party will consent to the settlement of third-party claims. That's exactly what E&I did here. They settled third-party claims without the consent.
That is a prohibition on their paying subcontractors?
They cannot settle third-party claims without the consent of Liberty Mutual. This is exactly what the government contracted for. They contracted for these two entities to resolve these types of disputes themselves. Because E&I didn't, they ended up expending this money for their claims and that they were no longer able to perform because they had run out of money. But what the government contracted for here was to not be a part of that. This puts all of this onus on E&I.
You may be right that the government's not part of this, but they're saying it's not our fault that we missed the deadline. Because the sureties didn't perform their obligation to pay the subcontractors. The only way we could go forward is to pay the subcontractors ourselves. And I don't understand why that fails to state a claim for converting the default termination into a termination.
Well, Your Honor, I think what gets lost here too a little bit is there were four different procedures where this claim in pieces was rejected by the trial court. This was at summary judgment. And what you'll notice in Judge Schapp's summary judgment opinion is that they never attached any affidavits or declarations. The simple point they made was we paid the subcontractors and we could no longer perform. They had the opportunity at summary judgment to produce evidence of this, to produce affidavits. All we're hearing now on appeal is an entirely different story than what we heard in that room at summary judgment. And in Judge Schapp's opinion, he says, and we talked about it in that hearing too, is where are the affidavits? Where are the declarations? If this is your story.
On this point?
Why is there no evidence? And,
on this point?
Yes, exactly. On all of this.
Where do we find that discussed in the summary judgment hearing?
You know, it's on page 15. Moreover, as the United States pointed out during oral argument, ENI has not even provided supporting affidavits regarding these invoices. So he's specifically talking about the invoice part of their claim.
No, but, we're not talking about the invoice part of that.
The point still holds because there was nothing attached to anything. There was no, I'm put in this position where I'm not dealing with evidence anymore. I'm dealing with things that a litany of attorneys along the way have changed. I'm dealing with the evidence that we had in this case.
You moved for summary judgment. You got summary judgment.
They moved for summary judgment and they explained their version of events. I then cross-moved under 12C, saying that they told us their story that they violated the contract. That doesn't warrant a default, or it doesn't warrant overturning the default termination.
Wait a moment. I'm confused. I mean, whether or not they were entitled to summary judgment, it doesn't resolve the claim. The Court of Federal Claims ruled in your favor, right?
Under Rule 12C on the default termination, yes.
Right.
But it was in response to them. We had thought of it in terms that you had laid out, but when they laid out their story, their version of
this. 12C is the judgment on the pleadings,
yes.
Right? And
yes.
There's a count in here for improper default termination. Mm-hmm. So how can you grant judgment on the pleadings when there's a count in the complaint that says it shouldn't have been a termination for default?
Because, Your Honor, the complaint was, as Judge Sapp said, was fairly ambiguous with regard to this. What we got from their motion was what they thought their claim, how they described their claim, and it illuminated what they thought had actually happened here. And because, as I said, they were not allowed to do any of this without the consent of Liberty Mutual. And so the decisions that they made in the performance of this contract is what led them to their inability to perform. And so what Judge Sapp said is, if beyond control is your argument for reversing this default termination, that's not what happened here.
It's not what happened. They allege that's what happened, and you have to have a trial to figure that out.
No, because what we pointed out to Judge Sapp is the contract documents that were all pointed to, that were all attached to the complaint, they assign responsibility for all of this to Liberty Mutual and ENI, and they set out how ENI was.
I mean, if they didn't perform and that caused the contractor to default, that's an excuse.
Right, but it's ENI that didn't perform, and it's ENI that breached its promise to the government.
Didn't perform because the sureties didn't do what they were supposed to.
I'm talking about the idea that they would unilaterally settle these payments to these subcontracts, alleged payments and alleged debts. But they were not allowed to unilaterally do that. That's where the problem
I don't see that the contract says they can't pay the subcontractors to get them to perform work. This provision is a common provision in contracts. You can't settle claims without the support of the other party. It's not a question of settling the claims. It's a question of, we gotta pay these people to get them to work.
But Your Honor, they were paying them for work that ENI asked them to do. They were paying off alleged debts that predated ENI's existence. So, I mean, at that point, these are clearly third party claims. They have nothing to do with ENI or ENI's performance. They date back to when Isolux was the prime contractor. These are debts that Isolux and thus Liberty Mutual owed these companies.
Counsel, you're relying on this third paragraph. Neither party will consent to a settlement. Mm-hmm. But there's an unless provision there with a couple of qualifications. Were those met?
Well, that's another problem that we have. You're talking about specifically the release of liability, right? We don't know that. There's no allegations of anything with respect to how they made these agreements, who they made these agreements with. We don't know anything about that. But yeah, you're right. That's one of the things that's required there is a release of liability. That was never alleged. They have alleged that they apply to the payment of money.
I mean, I regard your argument that this provision said prevents them from paying the subcontractor. It prevents them from eliminating the claim. It prevents them from doing something that has legal effect and binding on the sureties, but to say we have to pay these contractors to get them to work, otherwise we can't perform the contract, I don't see that this language remotely prevents them from paying the subcontractors under those circumstances. It seems to me a completely made-up argument.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree because we're talking about the settlement of third-party claims.
It's not a question of settlement. It's not a question of whether the claims were settled. It's just the contractor said, we're not going to work unless you pay us. And this language doesn't say you can't pay people to get them to work.
Well, right, Your Honor, but it says you can't settle third-party claims without the consent of the sureties.
Settling the claims. It's a question of paying them to get them to work.
But Your Honor, we have claims between a subcontractor and Isolux. So, and Liberty Mutual. So we have a third party claim from Acme Incorporated. That, they never even identified any of the subcontractors that were out there. We have a subcontractor third party claim that E&I says that they paid off. That's clearly settling a claim from a third party that really should have been settled by Liberty Mutual or not at all. We don't really know if there's any merit to these claims at all, which is part of the problem as well. We have no real idea of what any of these claims are. What the government contracted for here was to not have to deal with this dispute. So whatever E&I and Liberty Mutual, this is the agreement that they tendered. These are the terms that the United States entered into, which is if there are these issues out there, the two of you will resolve it. Your Honor, you asked a question that I think does bear returning to, which is this T4C idea. This came up at the very beginning of the trial, the very beginning of the case. And I asked them, what is your termination for convenience package look like here? What are the damages? And they said there aren't any. And it's because if there were, we could then remand it back to the agency to figure out if a T4C settlement was possible. But they said there weren't any, and so they declined the opportunity to remand it back. And that's how the termination for default sort of progressed on without any damages specifically to it. All the damages that they claim have to do with other aspects of this. They specifically
told us. Where do they say there was no damage from the termination?
It would have been in the transcript for the motion to dismiss hearing because
You're not pointing me to anything in the
journal. Well, I'm answering your question, Your Honor, of what a termination for convenience would look like. And we asked that question and it wouldn't look like anything because there isn't a package. There was never one submitted. And they've said there are no independent damages, regarding their termination for convenience.
Is it in the joint appendix so we can look at it ourselves, or is it not in the joint appendix? Just to follow up on what Judge Pike.
No, it's not, because it was something that they sort of conceded at the motion stage, and because there's no evidence of any T4C damages, so we never had anything to pursue. It was a conversation that we had at the very beginning to see if it made sense to quantify what a T4D conversion would look like.
There's no evidence on this because it was dismissed for failure to state a claim.
Well, but Your Honor, the 12C ruling happened at the end of discovery. It happened at the summary judgment stage. So discovery had closed.
But the basis for the ruling is failure to state a claim, right?
Correct. I mean, yes, it's judgment on the pleadings, but they sort of morphed together, right? I mean, under Rule 12. But that said, it did happen years into the case at the end of discovery, and only after they had sort of illuminated their arguments.
Well, maybe you're entitled to summary judgment on this issue. Maybe you could make case for that, but that's not what the Court of Federal Claims did.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's the only other questions. There are a couple other aspects that could have stood for some clarification, but I see that I'm out of time. So,
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hollow. Mr. Kernan has some rebuttal time.
Yes, Your Honor.
2.5 minutes.
Your Honor, with respect to the reference in the site to the plans and specifications, I was incorrect. It is in the appendix. 131 is a page reference. And you'll see there a chart that labels the specifications and drawings that are applicable. And the first one starts on December 21st, 2016. The plans and specifications that support those invoices were dated 2015, nowhere referenced in the contract with my client. The only thing that the Court of Federal Claims referenced was the publicly available somewhere in cyberspace. My client was to chase them down under a different contract number. That's not a properly put together contract, and my client should be able to recover for those plans under those plans and specifications.
Well, the drawings were part of the original contract with the prior contractor, right?
No, Your Honor. It was part of the solicitation, but under a different contract number, they were not provided to my client.
Forget about where they were supplied to your client. They were part of the contract, the original contract obligated the contractor to comply with those drawings, right?
If you look at the contract, it shows you on page 131 what are the plans and specifications you're to comply with, and those plans and specifications are not listed there. So my client would have no way to know. With respect to the issue of T4C, this will probably be one of the first contracts in history where a contractor terminated from default to convenience did not have any T4C costs, overhead costs, other costs. There's nowhere in the record where my client says that they don't have any T4C costs. Some ad hoc conversation isn't in the record that the counsel may have had with somebody at some point. There's no record of that. We would dispute that there's no T4C damages that we would raise somewhere if it got converted to a T4C. It may not be significant damages, but there would be damages.
Do you happen to have a citation in the record where E&I went to the sureties before making these payments? Like, is there a page you can give me, anything?
Not at this point, Your Honor. I don't know off the top of my head, the back and forth on that. So for the reasons stated, we would ask that this court convert the termination for default for termination of convenience and remand for further findings. We would ask that with respect to the invoices, it be remanded for further findings.
We can't convert this into a convenience termination.
Yeah, well,
the question is there a claim here that needs to be tried?
Correct,
Your Honor. It's not our job to imagine what the facts might be to support that claim.
Yes, Your Honor, I misstated that. You're correct. And further, with respect to the claim for good faith and fair dealing, that dismissal of that claim be remanded for further findings by the Court of Federal Claims. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted.